Be seated, please. Court is now ready to hear argument in 080669 Dan Kelly and Laura Hofstadter versus General Interior Construction, Inc.
May it please the court, Mr. Holmes will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Chief Justice and members of the court, may it please the court. This case can be distilled, we suggest, to a single question. In analyzing a claim of specific jurisdiction, is it sufficient for the plaintiff to plead or allege a cause of action against a non-resident where the cause of action has some relationship to Texas? Or must the plaintiff allege conduct by the defendant that has a substantial connection to the state of Texas? The Court of Appeals, the majority opinion, took the former approach, focusing on the existence of a cause of action that was related to Texas. The dissent and the prior decisions of this court take the latter position, that there must be a showing of conduct by the defendant in the state of Texas that has a substantial connection to the cause of action. This is illustrated by the Court of Appeals, the majority opinion's treatment of the claim under Chapter 162 of the Property Code. That's an unusual statute that one day this court may have to construe on the merits, which aren't here. It says that if money is paid by the owner in a construction project to the general contractor, that the funds are to be treated as trust funds for payment to the subcontractors. Now, there are other, it's not clear what the parameters of that are, because the statute goes on to say that these trust funds are not subject to the Texas Trust Fund Act, the Texas Trust Act, which governs trusts. So it's not clear what law really applies there, but that's not before us today. What the statute does provide is that there is at least a criminal penalty and possibly some sort of implied civil penalty that goes with non-payment of the funds by the general contractor to the subcontractor. Now, Mr. Kelly and Ms. Hofstadter are officers of Diva Consulting, and they had control or direction of the fund, and under the statute, they are defined as being subject to the trust fund obligation. They are trustees, whatever that means in the context of this particular statute.
Counsel, if you negotiate a contract with no intent to perform and with the intent to defraud someone, even though you are a corporate officer, do you not have some individual liability for that?
Yes.
And in this case, your clients negotiated this contract,
correct? I'm not sure that's in the record or not, but yes, it's certainly the corporation operated through its officers.
It signed change orders on the contract?
But beg your pardon?
Signed change orders,
yes.
Et cetera. Okay.
Yes.
So why aren't those contacts, if you will, at least as to the fraud and the trust claim, enough under this analysis?
Well, that when you turn to look at that claim, the starting point is, what were the allegations as to, there's still going to be a question of where did that happen? And as the dissent pointed out in the Court of Appeals, there was actually no jurisdictional allegation made by the, I'll refer to General Interior Construction as the plaintiff, although it's actually a third-party claim. They made no jurisdictional allegation as to actions taking place in the state of Texas. And we presented evidence saying that rebutting the existence of actions in the state of Texas. So the question would be under this record, yes, if Mr. Kelly and Ms. Hofstadter had come to the state of Texas and made and done what you just said, that would be a grounds for personal jurisdiction in Texas. The question would be whether there are pleadings or evidence to support that. And as the dissent correctly pointed out in the Court of Appeals, there weren't. There was no showing that Mr. Kelly or Ms. Hofstadter did anything in the state of Texas. Now, for example,
and some overnight trips or?
Well, they did make overnight trips. Yes, I'm talking about in connection with what you're talking about, the fraud cause of action. Yes, Mr. Kelly did make site trips to the location of the Hilton in Houston where he did things. And Ms. Hofstadter and Mr. Kelly certainly did have communications with General Interior Construction and the material men and other subcontractors relating to the construction project. Yes, they absolutely did. But none of these causes of action arise out of any of those contacts. There's no, for example, if Mr. Kelly had come to Texas and destroyed some General Interior Construction's equipment, clearly he would be subject to jurisdiction. If he had come to Texas and had committed fraudulent acts in Texas, certainly he would be subject to jurisdiction in Texas, absolutely. But there's no showing that if these promises, which are alleged in the third-party complaint, that any of those took place in Texas. For all we know, they took place in Arizona.
And well, let me ask you a question. This is just a practical question. You've got DEVA, and DEVA, let's say, under the Trust Fund Act, is holding funds that rightfully belong to the sub.
Yes.
And DEVA can be held in Texas.
Yes.
Because DEVA's wrongfully holding these funds. It's more of a constructive trust sort of theory, I think.
I think that's a good way of looking at it.
And then you take the individuals who control the company, sole shareholders, they're holding the funds as well under the Trust Fund Act.
Yes.
They're going to come here and defend the case against DEVA. They're going to be testifying in court. If they're holding the funds as well as the corporation holding the funds, what's wrong with subjecting them to the jurisdiction of the court, just on that claim?
I think that's an excellent question. And in fact, when I was reading the briefs in the last week, that's one of the questions that came to mind for me. How do I explain that to you? And I think the distinction there is there's a difference between coming here to be a witness and coming here to be a party. The arguments you make excellent sense if you get to the substantial justice and fair play and substantial justice prong of specific jurisdiction. Certainly, if you get to that point, we start looking at the convenience of the parties and issues like that. You can make a strong argument. But still, constitutionally, there have to be minimum contacts.
Well, sure there do. But if the purpose of the Trust Fund Act is to protect the sub,
yes,
then to fulfill the purposes of that act, anybody who's holding funds that rightfully belong to that sub, why shouldn't they be subject to the jurisdiction of the court if they come within the parameters of the Trust Fund Act?
Because you still have to have, unconstitutionally, there's still a due process issue. There still have to be minimum contacts.
And let's go through the due process. That favors, they're going to be here anyway. So in terms of due process concerns, those seem to be satisfied.
Well, except that that's the third element. The first element of the specific jurisdiction claim is purposeful availment. The second element is relationship of the contacts to the cause of action. The third element is fair play and substantial justice. That's where those sorts of considerations come into play, where you might say, this is a convenient forum, they're going to be here anyway. But under Supreme Court precedent, going all the way back to the days of Pennoyer versus Neff and all those international shoe and the like, in order for a person to be sued in the state, they have to have minimum contacts here. And the fact that the Texas legislature has passed a statute that creates liability on somebody is not going to be sufficient to satisfy the constitutional requirement of minimum contacts. For example, there are old cases which, gosh, I haven't read since law school, where various states tried to pass statutes that dealt with motorist statutes, that if you drive into our state, you're going to be subject to jurisdiction here. And ultimately, the way the courts and the legislatures all worked around that was by creating the legal fiction that if you drive into our state, you appoint the Secretary of State as your agent for service of process. But underlying all those cases is still the notion that a state legislature, cannot evade the constitutional requirement of due process by passing a statute making somebody liable. There still has to be the minimum contact. In the case of those motor statutes, driving into the state. In the case of the long-arm statute, doing business in the state, under any of those statutes, or in the case of the insurance statute, selling insurance in the state, there still has to be some minimum contact to the state. The state legislature does not have the power to override the 14th Amendment requirement of due process. So ultimately, there does still have to be the minimum contact. That's still going to be the bottom line analysis. And in fact, that's what this court talked about in the Michiana case, that the fact that there may be an impact in the state, there may be an effect in the state, is not sufficient by itself, that what the courts must look to, is the conduct of the state. As the court disapproved prior case law, holding that specific jurisdiction turns on whether a defendant's contacts were tortious, rather than on the contacts themselves. And this court stated that jurisdiction cannot turn on whether a plaintiff merely alleges wrongdoing. Well, I mean, in this situation, the fact that GIC has alleged a cause of action under the Trust Fund Act, as opposed to some other theory, that all that is a matter of pleading. It's invoking a particular theory, a statute in Texas, as opposed to looking at what was the conduct? What were the contacts to the state of Texas? In this case, it's not an academic distinction. There, as I say, there is a meaningful difference between being a witness in a state and being sued in a state. I've had, back in the days when I represented banks, I actually got sued once by a debtor saying that I had been mean to them in my debt collection activities. And I've testified as a witness in many cases on attorney's fees and the like. And I can tell you it was a meaningfully different experience actually being sued and having myself be the defendant. And that's a whole different ballgame. We would all, if we got sued, we would want to have the right to be sued where we live, with our own courts, with judges we voted for, with jurors who are our peers, who are our neighbors, who are the people we know who are like us.
Help me, if you would, with the fraud claim.
Okay, sure.
Suppose someone out of state never sets foot in the state, but designs from afar to defraud people in the forum.
Right.
And that's really the only purpose for the actions. All the actions occur outside the state, but it's not just a general fraud, whoever will come. It's really defraud that guy in Houston.
Yeah. Target, sure.
Would there be specific jurisdiction there?
I would think so.
And so what distinguishes that from this case?
We have to look at the record in this case of what was actually proven to have been done and where it was proven to have been done. There are only allegations here that there were promises made with no intention to perform them. What we've shown you is that, and this is in the record, that after we made the contract, we paid them, I think the number was $58,000. There was a payment issue down the road when there was a dispute between the parties. But I think the court should be wary of taking the path that perhaps you're suggesting, in that there are a great many cases where it's not very difficult to say, well, I've got a contract with a company from California, wherever, and I'm suing, and they breach it, and I'm suing them. And if I want to say, okay, well, I want to bring in the president, I want to bring in the vice president, I want to bring in the other people personally, I'm just going to say, well, you never really intended to fulfill this contract. That is, unfortunately, like it or not, it's an easy allegation to make. And it's easy thus to suck people, individuals, into the state of Texas with that sort of allegation. At a minimum, what the court should require is some showing that's more than what we have in this case, of where those promises took place, if they were made, some specificity about what the people did and the locus of the activity. In this case, we don't have that. Instead, what GIC has put in the record and what they rely on, and they've been relying on throughout this appeal, has been evidence that we, DEVA, through the officers and directors, gave a voucher to Maristar saying various things. This happened in Arizona. And that voucher was false. That's the evidence of fraud that they've actually put in the record. One Arizona resident giving a piece of paper they say is false, which we disagree with, but regardless, to another Arizona resident. Before you follow that path of letting people suck corporate officers and employees from out of state into Texas, you should at least require some sort of, prima facie showing that there really was something that they did that would subject some specific action they committed that would subject them to the jurisdiction of the state. But otherwise, as I say, it's ripe for abuse, and you could have all sorts of corporate officers and directors who being forced to personally defend themselves. And as I say, that is, having been on that side, and knowing that I'm being sued, in my case, I'm from Houston, I was being sued in Beaumont even. The fact that I was being sued in Beaumont in a community I didn't know, with judges I don't know, with jurors I don't know, was a gut-wrenching experience. Now, fortunately, it turned out well.
If you're a director, you're negotiating a contract, you have no intention of performing, you're coming to Texas to make sure everybody's doing everything that they should do under the contract that you negotiated, and those are your contacts with Texas to further your fraud, I mean, would you expect to someday be sued in Texas if that's what you were engaged in?
Certainly, and if that kind of factual showing had been made in this case, this would be a different case.
There was a showing that they did come here.
Yes, but there was no showing that they made any promises here.
And I guess we're looking at pleadings. Can you address their pleadings as they relate to the contacts with Texas by Kelly and Hofstadter?
Certainly. I looked at those pleadings.
53 seconds.
Yeah. Well, they simply say very little. They simply say something along the lines that Mr. Kelly, or I think they may have called them the officers in the pleading, I don't remember, that the officers made promises with no intent to perform, something like that. There was no, as I recall, not having it in front of me, there was very little specificity about where the promises were made, when they were made, to whom they were made. GIC had the obligation under the, you know, the going back to you Anchor versus Burt, whatever the name of the case was, and although that line of cases, to come forward with evidence and to specific pleadings to establish jurisdiction. They simply didn't do it. If they had, this might be a very different case. But as you pointed out, I'm about out of time.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Counselor. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
Court, Mr. Sears will present argument for the respondent.
Chief Justice Jefferson, Honorable Court, it's truly an honor to be here today, and Justice Guzman, congratulations on your recent appointment. If y'all see me shaking, I'm going to blame it on the temperature, not the fact that y'all are an intimidating bunch, and this is my first time here, but nonetheless, let me say this. Traditional notion of fair play and substantial justice is one of the cornerstones in the jurisprudence of this area. And I would submit to this court that allowing this petitioner to escape the jurisdiction of this court would be patently unfair and gravely unjust.
Well, I understand he pretty much conceded fair play and substantial justice works in favor of jurisdiction here, but that there has to be individual purposeful availment of the forum. And what evidence do we have that Kelly and Hofstadter individually avail themselves of the forum to subject themselves to the fraud and constructive trust claims?
Well, Judge O'Neill, that's a good question. And the answer is they came here, they literally had a business here, Diva Construction, they were doing a construction project on Hilton Hotel in Westheimer. They hired several subs here. They're in their individual capacity came here. I believe we had an affidavit in response. Certainly, we fled it, and also I think had an affidavit in response to one of the motions early on in the case by my client, Art Williams with GIC, that said Mr. Kelly came here and told him, look, we need you to do extra work. We need change orders. We're going to get you paid. We promise we're going to pay you. They owed him a total of about $300,000 on this project, and only paid him $58,000.
But that was as a corporate officer. That was, I mean, anybody who works for a company that travels on company business and makes those representations, what takes them out of the corporate capacity and puts them in an individual?
Unless you had no intent to perform that at the outset, Judge, in which case it becomes a tort, in which case it becomes specific jurisdiction as opposed to general, and I think it takes them outside the realm of the alter ego, or you don't have to pierce the corporate veil. But in addition to that, I'm sorry, Judge.
Let's talk about your pleadings, though, as they relate to the relationship between Texas and the contacts. Did you plead sufficient facts as to those contacts and why they occurred in Texas and how they relate to?
I certainly think I did, Judge, and I think Texas is a notice pleading state. I think we put them on notice, and I think without having to go into the merits of those claims, I think there's clearly evidence, and going a little bit further on what Justice O'Neill just asked and following up on what you're saying, Justice Guzman, excuse me, I mean, they took, in addition to what I just said, they came here and made these representations that they clearly did not intend to do, and we know that because on at least four, if not five occasions, they signed affidavits saying they'd paid subs when they hadn't.
Where was that done?
That was done in Arizona, yes, sir. And I'm going to touch that in just a second. I apologize, yeah. Judge. I promise.
No, that's fine.
But in answer to your question, they also took those funds under the Texas Property Code. And again, that exposes them individually. And my position before this court is, and I think the prior rulings from this court are, if you're doing business in this state, then you are subjected to the laws of this state. If you're profiting from a business in this state, you're clearly availing yourself to the state. And if it's
and some of that may have happened, but do you have to plead that some of that happened in Texas?
Well, Judge, if they're doing business in Texas and they are holding funds that belong to people in Texas, I guess that's the other problem of that is, and my opinion is those funds, even though they're coming from Arizona and they're paid in Arizona, they belong to residents of Texas. That's undisputed. Once that work was done, and by the way, in order for Diva, Larry and his wife to get, I call him Dan Kelly and Laura Hofstadt, in order for them to get paid, they had to submit affidavits with her notary
saying that we've already paid these subs.
Opposing counsel said that you should have to make a prima facie case of fraud to have these individuals subject to the jurisdiction of Texas. It sounds like perhaps you've made one.
I believe I have, Judge, and I believe, and I will say this. I mean, I think that the U.S. Supreme Court in Calder versus Jones in 1984 and also in Keaton versus Hustler both held out-of-state individual defendants liable, even though all their actions occurred out-of-state. They published articles. One was in the National Enquirer, I believe. One was from Florida. One was from California. They both held them individually liable, even though their actions occurred out of the state, and they never set foot in Texas, but they knew the results of their actions were going to occur in Texas. And in this case, I submit to you that when they submitted those fraudulent affidavits to say we've already paid these Texas subs, we want the money now that belongs, by the way, to these Texas subs, we're taking it in trust and we're supposed to give it to them, we're going to steal that money. There's no way they didn't know that that was going to be a ramification that was going to be felt in Texas. That money didn't belong to anybody in Arizona. It belonged to people in Texas.
What does it mean to divide jurisdiction between or among different causes of action? I mean, are you subject to the jurisdiction for tort but not contract? And what does that mean in terms of the trial of the case?
Well, Judge, I think the contract claim, candidly, was a little more difficult. And I don't necessarily fault the appellate court for kicking that out. And I haven't really re-urged it on appeal at this level because I think it is a little tougher because I think to say that they contracted in an individual capacity as opposed to through DEVA is a little trickier. But I think the case law is clear that if there's a tort, if you've committed a tort, the results or ramifications of which are felt in this state, you can be held individually liable. This court held that in Ratamco, which was the 2009 decision, where they talked about the Fraudulent Transfer and Conveyance Act. And that, if you remember, that defendant was in California. But they had allegedly consorted with people in Texas to fraudulently transfer some monies and some real estate. And this court held that they could be held accountable, even though they were in California and they never came to Texas.
So when Justice Frost said in dissent, she went through the allegations of misconduct, but she then said, notably, General does not allege that any of these acts occurred in Texas. You don't disagree with that, you just don't think it matters.
I didn't think it mattered in that case, and I certainly don't think it matters in this case either, Judge, for the reasons that I think this court has held in Ratamco and in Siskind, which was even an older court back in 82, but also the U.S. Supreme Court on the two cases I cited in Calder and Keaton, both held that even though they were out-of-state defendants that never set foot in the state, when you undertake an action that you know the consequences of which are going to harm a Texas resident, and you do it anyways, it is not far-fetched to think you might get sued in the state of Texas. And more importantly than that, this isn't like the Michiana case where that defendant never had any contact with Texas. These guys were doing business in Texas. They came to Texas. They made representations in Texas. And then they decided, under the Texas statute, we're going to be trustees and fiduciaries of your money, Texas residents' money. And I submit to you, they're bound by that statute. If you're going to do business in Texas, make money in Texas, you're going to be bound by Texas law. And one of the laws says if you steal our money, you can be individually liable. And I think for them to come in here and say that they shouldn't be, or that, yes, we got caught with our hand in the cookie jar, but we think we should be sued in Arizona instead of Texas, is disingenuous. And it certainly, getting back to what Justice O'Neill said, does not violate their due process rights.
Is it clear that a corporate officer acting as in a corporate or officer capacity is individually liable, as opposed to someone, say, who is acting as a sole proprietorship that would be liable individually under similar circumstances?
If I understand your question, Justice Green, are you asking if they're acting in their corporate capacity, can they still be held liable individually?
Right. I mean, obviously, if you've got an individual who runs a sole proprietorship business and contracting and so forth, and it's not a corporate entity, and he commits, say, a trust fund violation or an allegation, that's okay. There is some individual liability there. But an officer acting on behalf of a corporation and solely in that capacity, is it clear under the trust fund statute that there's individual liability in that instance?
I believe it is, Judge. I think it's very clear that they are individually accountable. And I also believe that this court and others have held that when you're talking.
But then how far would that go? Just the person who is alleged to have made the statement or committed the act, does it extend to all the officers and directors? How far does it go because it benefits the entire corporation?
Well, and candidly, I think that's a good question, Judge, and I think it probably doesn't apply. I have an easier answer in this case, and that's because there were only two shareholders, a husband and wife, that owned the business. So in this case, I think it would be simple. How far you took it beyond that, I don't know. I would certainly leave that to y'all's decision, perhaps on a future case. But with regard to this case, there's just a husband and wife running this business. They took the trust money and used it in their, they've said they put it in their corporate account, their general account, and used the money to fund their general business, which I think is in violation of the act. And it specifically states they can be individually liable. But also, I think anytime you allege a tort, which I think the fraud is, and I also think violation of that statute is, then the corporate shield doctrine does not apply, particularly when you're suing for specific jurisdiction as opposed to general jurisdiction.
Mr. Sears, it seems like you're implying that we need to look at the size of the business unit. If you have two shareholders, then perhaps there's a different burden or different test for perhaps a major corporation that has not its direct officers down to negotiate deals in Texas, but some subordinate.
You know, Judge, the short answer is I think that the people that are responsible for handling the account in which the trust funds were administered are probably the ones that should be held accountable. How far down the train that goes, I don't think it should go any further than those that actually took the money, were in charge of the money, and responsible for the money. But in this case, I think it's a simpler answer, and that is because there's only two of them, and they both handled the account. So I think it's an easier decision.
Well, that seemed to catch my attention, but I don't know if that's a proper legal analysis.
Well, if it's not, I apologize.
I'm wondering. I don't know if it is.
Well, all I know, Judge, is that the statute, and prior to this case, I'd never dealt with it before, never even heard of it, but the statute's very clear that you are a trustee of those funds, and if you violate that trust, you can be held individually liable.
And that's true, but when we're looking at your pleadings, we're looking at the allegations, the jurisdictional allegations, what you pled about those officers and their connection with Texas. So how did you plead your jurisdiction over these officers?
Well, Judge, and my recollection is, and the record will speak for itself, but I pled that they committed fraud by coming here and make representations individually, by the way, to my client, the president of the company, and it's arguably in the capacity of, but he came here and told my guy, keep working, because my guy kept complaining he's not getting paid, and you keep asking me to do more work, and he says, you're going to get paid.
And if your petition fails to mention Texas or that any of that occurred in Texas, then what effect does that have as it relates to their burden to negate all basis for jurisdiction?
Well, I think it does, Judge. The implication is that since all the work was here, the project was here, the contract was here, my clients were here, the representations were here, everything about this transaction was here, literally, except the trust money. I think it's implied by the facts of the case. And then to follow up on that, I think you're right, Judge, that once that is pled, I think it's their burden to negate that element, and to say that somehow jurisdiction by this court would be patently unfair on them, and I don't think they've done that. I don't think they can show that having jurisdiction over them in this case would be an unduly burdensome or somehow a violation of their due process rights, and what they're asking really is, we want you to allow two lawsuits on the same facts, same witnesses, same damages, same everything. We just want you to have to sue part of it in Arizona and part of it here. I mean, there's no dispute that Diva suit's going to be going here, and they want to do the same exact case all over again in Arizona. And I don't think that the due process requires that to happen.
And then you agree, though, that if you didn't plead jurisdictional allegations, that all they had to show then was present evidence that they were non-residents of Texas, and then the inquiry is over, at least at this stage, if you failed to plead sufficient jurisdictional facts or allegations?
I don't think I did, I think it is in the pleadings, Judge, and if it's not, then I certainly don't think they have met their burden to show that somehow jurisdiction on them is going to violate the due process.
What are there more statutory damages for the fraud and the are there more damages for fraud and the statutory violations than would exist for the contract breach and other commercial questions?
Potentially, given the fact that it has punitive damage implications, potentially, Judge. So in that sense, yes. But I mean, I will point this out, Judge, because there's been, I mean, in addition to that, there's another court out of the Houston Court of Appeals, 2005, first court, that was the Glatleys versus CMS. It's GLATTLYS. It is identical. Suing a contractor under the same statute, same provision. Those were Illinois defendants. They made the same exact arguments that this defendant's making here. All of our action, all of our alleged fraud occurred there. The trust money was there, and the court held that there was jurisdiction because the consequences of the acts were felt here. And I think, again, that's 100% supported by the Calder, the Keaton, and the previous cases cited by or ruled on by this court, where it's held that if even though your actions are outside the state, if the consequences of it is directed to this state, you can be held responsible in this state, which makes sense.
We changed directions just a little bit back to something we've talked about. It. So I understand it. Maristar, the owner of the project, paid money to DEVA.
Yes, sir.
DEVA held those funds in its corporate accounts out of state.
Yes, sir.
Your client, one of the subcontractors, GIC, was allegedly not paid.
Yes, sir.
What specific statutory language makes the two shareholders and officers of this entity, DEVA, personally liable? In your brief on page 11, you cite to 163.003 of the Texas Property Code and a Houston Court of Appeals case. And then further down, you say these persons may be held personally liable without a direct citation, without a citation at all. What specific language do you contend makes these two individuals liable for the handling of the funds in DEVA's corporate accounts?
Judge, if I have left it out of my brief or misstated the section, I thought it was 162.003, but I don't have a copy of it with me here today, believe it or not.
162.
I'm sorry.
I can read the part of it, and maybe this will ring the bell. It's pretty short. 162.003 of the property code here says, among others, a subcontractor who furnishes labor and materials for the construction in this state is a beneficiary of any trust funds paid or received in connection with the improvement. Is there something in that language that you think makes these two individuals liable?
Judge, my short answer would be, without having it in front of me, I don't know. I can certainly supplement my brief, but I will say this. I don't think it's even contested, Judge. I mean, I think they agree that they can be held individually liable. They're just saying it has to be in their state, not our state.
That issue does go to liability as opposed to necessarily personal jurisdiction. But, I mean, the statement's been made several times, and I'm trying to find the exact basis for that conclusion.
I don't remember it off the top of my head, Judge, and I know the minute I sit down I'm going to remember it, but I apologize, and I'd be happy to do a supplemental brief on it if I need to.
Why don't you supplement with a letter? I don't think you need much more than that.
Okay. Thank you, I would counsel. Be happy to, and I apologize that I didn't have it for you here today, Justice Wainwright. But again, I think that is not an issue that they're contesting. I think the statute clearly says they can be individually liable. I would have sworn it was in my brief, but nonetheless, I mean, I think that goes to the liability, and they're contesting more the jurisdictional end of it. And I would submit to the court that when you look at the pattern of the ruling of this court, from BMC Software to Michiana to Moki Mac, I mean, it's always been the reason that jurisdiction has been denied is because these were parties that were outside the state that had little, if any, contact, certainly not any purposeful availments, I believe was the gist of the rulings. And then the contacts with the court were not substantial related to whatever minimal contacts they had. And in this case, I mean, I think you have a situation where they are doing business in Texas. They're hiring subs in Texas. They're taking trust money on behalf of Texas subs. And by the way, this isn't the only sub. There were two or three other subs that got stiffed as well, that were formerly part of the case, and they're in the original petition. And I think it's all part of the record. I'm not speaking outside the record. But so the bottom line is they took trust
is
money.
Is the main case still pending?
I think most of the other subs, Judge, were so small. They resolved it with Maristar and didn't pursue it. My sub was the largest sub and had the largest loss, and therefore they decided and was more determined to make sure that they didn't get stiffed, and so they've sent me here today. So,
just to put a little final point on what I was asking about before, under the Trust Fund Act, Diva Construction would be liable if they committed the acts that you've alleged under that statute, right? But the corporate entity that had Maristar's funds paid to Diva in part to pay the subs, those funds were in Diva's corporate accounts. Diva would be liable if it did the things you've alleged this statute, right? The question is the individual officers and shareholders of Diva. You're not alleging any kind of piercing theory. You're saying the individuals did something that made them individually liable under this statute.
Yes, sir. The statute specifically says, as shareholders of an entity that receives the trust money, you can be individually liable. The shareholders and operators of the entity can be individually liable. And again, Judge, I mean, we clearly have, there's never been a dispute about the jurisdiction over Diva. The issue is, now that Diva has been shelved and basically is a skeletal company and they've left the Texas residents with no recourse, given the fraud claims and the breach of this Texas statute claim that were intentionally done with the knowledge that it was going to be felt in Texas, does that subject them individually to the jurisdiction of this court? I believe that it does, and I believe that to let them not be held to the jurisdiction of this court would be a grave injustice, and I hope that the court doesn't do that. And I notice I'm almost out of time, but I'm happy to answer any more questions if you have it.
Otherwise, any further questions?
Thank you. It was a great experience, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Sears.
Thank you for the opportunity.
If the individuals are fiduciaries vis-a-vis the subcontractor, where would the breach of fiduciary duty occur if they don't pay over the funds that they're obligated to pay?
Well, you identify one of the fundamental problems we've got with the statute in that, on the one hand, it refers to these as trust funds. But on the other hand, it doesn't say what duties arise out of that. If these people are fiduciaries, as we use that term in common law, then they could not commingle the money in their general operating account, but the statute allows them to do that. If they have the ordinary liabilities of trustees, those would be governed by the Texas Trust Act.
But they're not. And so let's say that it's just they're a fiduciary of the sub. Let's just make that presumption with me. Then why doesn't the breach of fiduciary duty occur here by non-payment of funds that rightfully belong to the sub?
Well, I'm not sure the money would be in Arizona in a bank account there, and when it is used for some other purpose, that would take place in Arizona.
No, but I'm talking about the breach of fiduciary duty. If it's my duty to turn funds over to you, I'm your fiduciary, then why does the breach not occur in the state where I fail to pay the funds?
Well, I understand you can certainly make that argument, but the standard is the ultimate issue is going to be not the locus of the cause of action per se. That would be a question of choice of law. Does Texas law apply, for example? You look at the locus of the cause of action. But rather what we're looking at would be minimum contacts. And as the court held in Michiana, then we're talking about conduct. Looking to conduct, not to pleadings, not to causes of action. What is the conduct that we're looking at? And the conduct all took place in Arizona.
Well, but you keep saying that. But, you know, if the conduct is withholding your funds, then it seems like the conduct, the breach is something that could be occurring in Texas. If you're supposed to pay those funds in Texas and you don't do that, why isn't the breach directed at Texas?
Well, perhaps it is. But again, in Michiana, what the court held was that where the consequences of something are felt is not determinative. It's where the conduct is felt. It's admittedly, sure, the prior to Michiana.
There, the conduct was committed out of state.
Yes.
Here, if you say that the breach, failure to pay the funds, it occurs in Texas, then why wouldn't that come within the conduct within Texas?
Well, that's not conduct per se. It's not a physical act.
It's a breach. The breach of fiduciary duty occurred in Texas, why doesn't that give you sufficient context?
Well, that's a legal consequence as opposed to conduct. The actual conduct what the court said in Michiana's, if we look at the, it's easier to look at the bright line of where is the, I'm not sure, that's not the language of the court.
Well, that was a directed a tort case. I mean, that was a little bit different.
Well, yes, I certainly agree with that. But nonetheless, we had to look at the parameters of the law, and what the court has said is we look at conduct. And the mere fact that somebody does something in another state, even if it's in some sense foreseeable that it will cause the consequences in another state, that's not going to be good enough for to establish minimum contacts.
But I don't want to beat this to death, but you know, if I steal your money from another state, if I'm in Arizona and I steal your money out of an account, why would I not? Why would that not be conduct directed at Texas? Why wouldn't I be subject to liability here? Because that's basically what the Trust Fund Act claim is, that you've stolen that money from the subs.
Well, I think the answer there was that if money was stolen in Arizona and you have no other contacts to Texas, that I would have to sue you in Arizona in that situation. I wouldn't have the right to sue you in Texas based on you stealing money from me in Arizona. Because once again, you would have committed you would have no conduct, no minimum contacts to Texas, other than the mere fact that I happen to be a Texas resident. If my money's in Arizona, then that's where the theft occurs. But if I could, I want to answer a question and save Mr. Sears necessity of filing.
I was actually coming to that. On a prior page in the respondent's brief, it does mention 162.002, not for this direct proposition, but looking at 002, it does say an officer or director who has control of the direction of trust funds is a trustee of the trust funds.
Yes,
you concede that could make Mr. Kelly and Ms. Hofstadter personally or individually liable?
I think, yes, that's under their interpretation, yes. I mean, there's an open question as to whether the statute creates a private cause of action as opposed to being criminal liability, and there's questions as to what the nature of the private remedy would be. We're not here on that today. He's pleaded that that's a cause of action, and for purposes of this proceeding, you have to assume that he's right. So, yes, I would agree with that.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. That cause is submitted, and that concludes all arguments for this morning. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.